This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 7th of July 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to episode 209 of the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bound, and Andrew Tuck.
On today's show, we look at the often savage relationship between two great rivals with the author of a new book titled China's War with Japan.
Plus, whatever happened to the American dream that President Kennedy dreamt of.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
Then George Packer from The New Yorker contemplates a world that he says is witnessing the unravelling and disintegration of the United States.
And it's everyone's favourite pastime, Lego. We'll go brick by brick to find out how this innovative toy managed to conquer the world.
That's all to come, plus Tom Edwards with next week's news and perhaps some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Oh yeah, I can almost hear the clicking of the cicadas. I can almost sort of smell the burning of a small Greek fire in a village in the middle of nowhere. Andrew, I feel like we've just put Med to bed.
We have put Med to bed,
and my favourite Russian tennis player. He's out of Wimbledon, isn't he? He's not playing in the final today.
It's quite a good name, Med to bed, isn't it?
Med to bed.
Now listen, you've got too much of a tan already. But are you going?
You're not even looking at me. You've got too much.
No,
of a tan.
I've got.
It's like you're
already.
Writing that down
you're
in your editor's notebook.
You're glowing. You're glowing.
This is from last weekend when I was in Sussex.
Okay, and you didn't go to see the Stones, did you?
No.
Now, can I just say...
I'm a bit sad. I don't want to talk about it.
Mick Jagger, it's very difficult to tell him apart from your impersonation of him.
Well, that's nice, because he's 67 or something.
No, it's not the look, it's the voice. It's the voice.
Yeah, he's got... Well, someone wrote a thing about this, about a review of the Stones in a newspaper, and they said it's impossible to tell Mick Jagger apart from an impersonation of Mick Jagger. He does have that thing.
No, I know.
I felt like a hillbilly there, just for a minute. Just for a minute, though.
I was going to say, because it does normally take a few drinks to get it out of you. Can we have one more bit of Mick? Go on.
What do you want to have? Because all the best impersonation of Mick, which everyone steals, are the one from Stella Street, which is a sort of not enough love British sitcom.
Go on, do it then.
And it was when he and Keith Richards ran a corner shop together. That was the premise of this thing. And he'd be like, "Hey, Keith, where's the Savlon?" Like that, you know, and he talked like that, and he was always like, "We decided that we've been on the road for too long, and you know, me and Keith decided we were getting old, you know." And he said, "Let's set up a corner shop. The history, the future of the Rolling Stones, Keith, is retail." Anyway, that's where it comes from. I don't think we should do the rest of the show like this. Last time I did this, they cut it out of the show anyway.
I love that. That's made me very happy.
It didn't make it to the podcast version.
So for all the people who didn't get to see the Stones at Glastonbury, there's Rob.
I think they should come. I think we should invite them on the karaoke night next time Tyler takes us out to the karaoke joint.
Come and pitch a tent round here.
I'll help you.
And watch Rob.
You can help me pitch mine. Okay. Bang the pegs in. The Teds in. We should get Tedwards in.
Yes, let's get him in.
Let's get him in for his news look ahead.
It's Sunday, it's midday, live from London, this is the Monocle Weekly. And with his look ahead to the week's events, here's Tom Edwards.
And you're listening to Radio 2.
It does have that kind of vibe.
It does, doesn't it? It's sort of like 80s Radio 2 vibe to it.
I'm happy with that.
Can you do any impersonations?
No.
Yes, he can.
Wait, I can't.
He can. Who knows? Let's look through the glass. Does Tom know any? Yeah, he does.
Which one?
Steve Bloomfield's turned up today, and he reckons that you do a mean impersonation of whom? Ronnie Corbett.
Oh, go and do that.
Okay. Look at his face.
We should say for our listeners that aren't familiar with British comedy duos of the 1980s that he was one of the two Ronnies. He's the surviving member of the two Ronnies. He's one of my heroes.
Oh dear me! Well, this is getting off to a bad start.
It is. I want you to do. Can you do the news look ahead in the style of Ronnie Corbett?
I actually cannot do that.
As I said to my producer, and then you do the little thing with your glasses.
I wear glasses. That's why I get compared to Corbett
like Ronnie
or
Corbett.
Anyone who basically wears glasses, including Eric Morecambe. Thanks, Andrew Tuck.
Do you like the way the whole segment is now about Ronnie Corbett?
No, I'm sure that'll be very popular. I imagine particularly listeners in, for example, Southeast Asia, probably punching the air in delight at the development.
Again, this is, I love a radio in-joke, but this is really this is taking it a step too
he's
far.
He's very popular, though. He's a bit, it's a bit like, what's his chops in Albania?
Who else is Norman Wisdom. In Albania?
Wisdom, who is an absolute legend there, sort of inexplicably.
Right, off with the news, then.
Let's start with something. This is fairly serious. Big talks in Europe tomorrow. US and European Union launching a free trade zone, which would create the world's largest free trade zone. But it's beset by problems before it's even got started, because obviously France wants these talks suspended. They're not happy about the whole spying controversy. You know, we've been following this in the last couple of weeks. The US, it can't really have come as that much of a surprise, but apparently it did to some of our friends on the continent, that the US is browsing what they're browsing, having a little bit of an earwig, listening in. They're not best pleased. So that it could undo this whole free trade association before it even gets started. There's some other interesting things happening tomorrow. Of course, it's the death anniversary of Kim Il-sung, founder of North Korea. And that's always quite intriguing. It always intrigues me how the state commemorates its founder, its dearly departed.
There'll be a lot of there'll be a lot of very public weeping, I should imagine.
That's very
choreographed
big
crying.
Possibly adjacent to the mausoleum where his embalmed body is. Just an intriguing side note.
Now, isn't he peculiarly, oddly, still the leader of the country? I don't think he's meant to be dead, isn't he? He's kind of just... He's just not around much these days.
Yeah, I think he's kind of physically...
He's having a lie down. He's having a lie down.
Of course, his body is still there. So he's almost good to go.
He's given in his holiday form to the great big editor in the sky.
Absolutely. Let's press on. So this is a little bit of a sort of British summer institution.
Oh, yeah.
A Goodwood, you know, home, of course, of racing.
People love a bit of Goodwood.
But the Festival of Speed, which is one of my favourite events, when people basically race racing cars and great cars irresponsibly around a country estate.
My favourite thing about the Goodwood Festival of Speed is it does recreate the kind of bygone age, the golden era of motor racing or Formula One, 1950s, where it was just hay bales to stop you.
Well,
which, surprisingly enough, are quite flammable and not that doesn't really sort of stop you.
And yet, some people survive. And Rob, that takes me exactly to where I was going to go.
Yes.
Because Bonhams are auctioning some amazing cars. They always do every year. The highlight lot is from the 50s, a 54...
Is it a Van Wall or something?
It's a Mercedes-Benz W196.
That was the original Silver Arrow.
Juan Manuel Fangio's world championship winning vehicle. It's going under the hammer. What a joy.
They shouldn't put it under the hammer. It'll get dented.
It might need some dents knocking out of it.
God! I literally feel like I thought there's three Ronnies in the room now.
There's the three Ronnies. The sequel no one wanted.
Yes.
And that's going home. Now, we don't know how much that's... We don't even know what the asking price is.
That would be a mega.
It could be monster. I wonder whether it will get up to the 16.4 million all-time record, which is for a Ferrari 250 from around the similar era. But there's plenty of other great stuff up for grabs. You can buy loads of old, you know, there's Steve McQueen paraphernalia, all sorts of stuff. Wonderful. And the Festival of Speed itself, which is amazing.
They're doing the auction down there at Goodwood?
Absolutely, on the first day. That's on Thursday. And then it all unfolds during the week. It's a special 50 years of the Porsche 911.
That'd be nice
as well.
It's a good weekend and in God's own county of Sussex.
Absolutely. I know you're a fan.
My parents are down there so often, I think they might have moved in.
There's worse places to go, I must say.
Yeah, exactly.
I went last year.
Oh, that's right.
I did go.
You were mixing. Why did you not purchase a vintage racing car?
Well,
you were for the nags or the cars?
I went there for the cars. But the strange thing was, it was very difficult to get there because there were so many cars going there.
So you should have arrived at the car bit on a horse.
Yeah, exactly.
That would be a connoisseur's choice.
That'd be great.
Mix it up.
I don't know how we can better that. What a wonderful news look ahead.
Let's end it there then.
Tom, thank you so much for your news look ahead. Thank you for coming in. It's a pleasure as always. We'll see you in here next week.
Same time next week. I'll be there.
Laters.
The Chinese-Japanese relationship has been in the news of late, namely over the ongoing dispute over the Senkaku Islands, marine patrol boat incursions into each other's territory, or the upping of political rhetoric. Senkaku also highlights the tense and often fragile relationship between the two countries.
Much of that tension emanates from the aftereffects of the Sino-Japanese theatre of World War II, which saw imperialist Japan try to conquer much of Asia. A new book by Rana Mitter titled China's War with Japan tries to highlight those long-held tensions, as well as highlight the role the war played on the world. I caught up with Rana earlier this week when he popped by Midori House and began by asking him whether the release of his book was serendipitous.
Yeah, well, in a sense, Rob, it's a good time to visit the topic for a slightly alarming reason, which is that anyone who keeps half an eye on the Asia-Pacific region just over the last few months will have seen that there have been some worrying signs. You occasionally see reports in the Western press of, say, Japanese battleships appearing in the East China Sea or Chinese fighter jets over a set of small uninhabited islands. And you sometimes wonder what on earth all this is about. Well, I'd say that, put very simply, it's the unfinished business of 1945 in Asia, the end of World War II, in which China was actually a very important player. And this is something in the West we tend to forget. But I would say that looking at the history of this period now is a really good way of understanding one of the most dynamic, but also most volatile regions of the world. That's one of the reasons why actually just a mere 10 years or so ago, I decided I'd start writing this book. The research, I have to say, was something that took quite a while. Yeah. That may be one of the reasons why it's taken so long for the book to come out, and perhaps others haven't yet embarked on this process.
I like the fact that it was is now a good time to publish it. Actually, 10 years ago would have been even better, but it was such a long book.
Well, no, 10 years ago, I didn't realize. In fact, 10 years ago would have been worse on the grounds that China wasn't quite in all of our eyes in the way that it is now. So I'd love to claim that, you know, it was foresight. It was more the fascination of the topic that really kept me going on it. But just at the moment the book's come out, I think we have reached a moment where China is very much part of our present day and our future, and the history is a really important part of understanding that. So I hope the book does play that wider purpose.
And without wanting to get into the mechanics of how you wrote the book, I think the research, you touched on the research there briefly, that's an interesting thing. How easy was it to get the information, the research? How easy is it to access the archives in China to write a book like this?
The answer is not very. And that's one of the other reasons why, up to now, we haven't had that many comprehensive histories of this war. I mean, I should just say there are lots of fantastic colleagues, I won't name them all, but, you know, around the world, who have written various important specialist studies on parts of this war. So it's not unknown territory by any means. But, you know, one book you can pull off the shelf and find out what on earth happened. That's something I think we've needed. And to do that, I've had to go to archives in Shanghai, in Chongqing, the old wartime capital of China, which is down in the southwest, the United States as well, and Britain. But it's not quite as easy as popping down to, I don't know, the British Library or, let's say, you know, the National Archives in Washington and asking them to bring you the documents. It involves a little bit more detective work, a little bit more diplomatic work to actually get your hand on those rustling pieces of paper that make it all possible.
Indeed, I can imagine it must be a bit of a paper chase. In the Western front, as it were, or the European theatre, the war, we can kind of easily measure out our allegiances and maybe the personalities of the countries involved by the leaders involved. And our thoughts on China and Japan, that theatre, or the Asian theatre, is maybe cloudy because we don't have a handle on the personalities, the leaders involved. Obviously, there was Chiang Kai-shek and Mao was sort of a bit part player at this time versus the Emperor of Japan. Well, who are the personalities involved?
Well, this is one of the things that's most puzzling and yet most interesting, because actually there are huge, big personalities involved with this story. It's just that until recently, they've been a bit obscured. I mean, Mao is a figure who everyone's heard of, and of course there have been recent biographies and studies. Was he a good guy? Was he a bad guy? Was he something else that have assessed him? What hasn't really been looked at is the role of how much the communists actually helped to win the war. And one of the things that I think the book says is that because Mao's personality was so big, he was a man who had a vision not just of China, but really of China's place in the world, that we ignore the fact that the communists didn't actually do that much fighting in the war relative to some of the other Chinese. They did fight, no question about that, but they were secondary players. So who is the major player? Well, that's a figure who you've just mentioned in passing, a name that people may know but not know much about, and that's Chiang Kai-shek. For, you know, more than 20 years, the leader of China on the mainland, including the 8 years of the war. And let's not forget, Rob, that for the Chinese, World War II lasts 8 years, from 1937 to 1945. Mm-hmm. We sometimes complain the Americans don't acknowledge that the Europeans came into the war two years before Pearl Harbor, but we forget the Chinese were there 2 years before that. And Chiang Kai-shek was the man who basically stood up and said, we will not accept any more invasion of our country by Japan. And in a way that's actually very reminiscent of Winston Churchill, effectively said the equivalent of, we will never surrender. And even when China's position looked most hopeless, he was actually absolutely adamant about that one thing, that he wasn't going to sit back and let the Japanese take it. And that leads to the final personality, someone who's really been forgotten, but I think is one of the most fascinating characters in this book. A man called Wang Jingwei, who collaborated with the Japanese. He made the calculation the other way. A year and a half after the war had broken out, China was being smashed into oblivion. It looked impossible to get any foreign allies, so he went to talk to the Japanese and set up a government in cooperation with them. And those three men, Mao, Wang and Chang, really tell the story of China's war between them.
And what was the style of fighting? I mean, obviously the Japanese invaded, famously as the rape of Nanking or Nanjing, which was one of the sort of one of the most infamous sort of theatres of war and sort of aspects of that part of the war. What was the rest of the style of fighting? Did the Chinese throw troops? Were they tactically what you might call tactically naive, or did they simply throw troops at the problem? Were they technologically advanced? How did that bear itself out?
Well, the one thing the Chinese had, and you may not be surprised to hear about this, is a lot of manpower.
Yeah.
There were a lot of troops who could actually be put into the battles. The problem is that with the exception of a few tens of thousands who had actually had German training, they were not trained in modern warfare. And there are a whole variety of academics, including Hans van der Ven and others, who have looked at the question of the actual military training. But if you look at the big picture, what you see is this. For the first 2 years or so of the war, from 37 to about 38, 39, you do have lots of big set-piece battles of a type that we'd recognise in the West. And again, this is one of the curious things about China in World War II. Everyone can pull out from their cultural memory names like El Alamein, or even in the Pacific theatre, Iwo Jima, Saipan, these sorts of names. But nobody knows about Taizhuang, Changsha, Wuhan, these other really big battles on the Chinese mainland, where the Chinese nationalists, the so-called Kuomintang party of Chiang Kai-shek, sent in hundreds of thousands overall, over the course of the war, millions of troops to fight against the Japanese. Now, we have to remember that had they not done that, then the whole history of post-war Asia might have been very different. And the communists were there too, but they fought more on the guerrilla side. They were not aiming to defeat the Japanese in big set-piece battles. Instead, they were sending out often very well-trained and cleverly armed troops who would harass the Japanese, try and make life difficult for them. Both sides, of course, were waiting for the Allies to enter the war. That was what they were really playing for.
And how is this war dealt with culturally in China and maybe in Japan as well? Maybe China, because we know less about it. You mentioned a few names there of things that have obviously been made into films, places that have been made into films, and their sort of legendary status has been cemented on celluloid in a way. Without being flippant, how do these things bear them out culturally? And I wonder, even in Chinese schools.
Well, I'd say culture is a battlefield. It's one of the areas where the differences between China and Japan are still felt in a very raw and direct way. Just to give you one or two examples of what I mean by that. One form, you mentioned film, and of course some listeners will know movies like Zhang Yimou's Flowers of War about the rape of Nanking, released a couple of years ago. Also Lu Chuan's City of Life and Death. To be honest, I think a better film than the Zhang Yimou film, but dealing with the same issue. But a lot of people won't know that one of the ways in which young people in China experience, if that's the right word, the war, is through multiple player video gaming. One of the biggest massively multiplayer games that exists out there in China is a variation on different battles during the war against the Japanese. And very interestingly, of course, the propaganda authorities keep a close eye on this. They're quite happy to support it. But there's one rule: you can play different Chinese generals, but you can't play the Japanese if you're a Chinese player. That says something about what they want players to get from this particular game.
Yeah, it does seem like looking around down the wrong end of a telescope somehow. And in doing your research for this book, were there any surprises thrown up by this? Were there lots of things that you didn't realise, that there were personalities that were stronger than you at first thought, campaigns that were more decisive than maybe some Western historians had first thought?
Yes, I'd say that there were two major things that really surprised me. The first one was actually how fierce the fighting was and how important the Chinese resistance was. There's still a great tendency, even amongst, you know, World War II buffs, if you might put it that way, and these tend to be more the military historians. I don't claim to be a military historian myself. In a sense, this is really about the politics and society that comes from wartime. It's a slightly different, although important, issue. But seeing just how long these people resisted against this amazingly technologically superior force of Japan was really a very inspiring thing to construct. And I hope that readers will gain that when they read it. But the other thing, and this may be a bit more controversial, is that I found myself not agreeing with, but sympathising with those who thought that things were hopeless and tried to make a deal with the Japanese. Not because they liked the Japanese, not because they thought that they were necessarily going to do everything that was wonderful for China, but rather at this particular moment in 1938 when the situation looked hopeless, they had to see things not as we do, in retrospect, but at the time. And the diary of one man, a top official called Zhou Fuhai, was a wonderful source for this because day by day, month by month, you see him agonizing over decisions. Should we go over to the Japanese side or should we continue to resist? There's a great quote from his diary where he says, just as he's about to take a flight, which will eventually send him off into this very difficult decision, he says, do heroes make circumstances or do circumstances make heroes? I think that's true of all wars, but it's certainly true of this one.
I want to leave a huge silence after you said that, because that's going to make everyone, I think everyone wants to scribble that down. I think people are going to get tattoos of that.
Well, maybe
it's a
we'll
good quote.
Maybe we'll start a Zhou Fuhai fan club. We could get t-shirts or whatever together.
It's pretty good, isn't it? And how much of this war made China communist after the war? And how much of it, I mean, it's a strange fallout, perhaps, that, you know, China became communist and a Cold War enemy of the West, and Japan became an ally after being a hated enemy.
In less than 5 years, yeah. The position of these two massive giants of East Asia flips between 1945 and 1949, and nobody remembers much about the former part. Well, I think the answer to your question comes, I can't give you a better source than Chairman Mao. 1972, he's meeting, I think, the Japanese Prime Minister at that time, top leader. And the Prime Minister, of course, 30 years previously, had been a private soldier in the China War on the Japanese side. And Mao said, with that irony for which he was known, I want to thank you, Japanese, for invading China. Because if you hadn't done that, we in the Communist Party would never have come to power. Now, we're not absolutely sure this is a bottom, you know, copper-bottomed quote, but it's been said quite a lot. And the sense behind it is absolutely right. Had it not been for the utter destruction, you know, 14 million dead or more, 80 million refugees, the modernization of China that was happening in the 30s before the communists smashed, you know, to pieces, then the situation that allowed a complete social revolution might well not have happened in that way. So perhaps the greatest beneficiaries of the war against Japan were the Chinese Communist Party.
That was Rob there with Rana Mitta, author of China's War with Japan.
We're going to have some music now. This track came out in March through Heavenly Records. It comes from the album of the same name. This is My Heart Skips a Beat by Toy.
And that was My Heart Skips a Beat by Toy. If you like them, you can catch the band at the BBK Festival Bilbao in Spain on July the 11th. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
The results are out. Monocle's 7th annual Quality of Life survey has shuffled the deck and ranks the cities we think are most livable in 2013. And the winner is Copenhagen.
This is a population and a city that's become markedly more extrovert in recent years. There's more life on the streets than ever before, and its people are not only more engaged locally, but also eager to show Copenhagen off to the rest of the world. Copenhageners have hit a high point of pride in their city, and it shows.
Copenhagen, our film about the best city to call home. On Monocle.com.
And welcome back to the Monocle Weekly with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound. We're broadcasting from Studio One in Midori House. Now, is the United States of America really a shining city on the hill?
The energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country.
President Kennedy there challenging Americans to become a model society for the world, a nation that others would strive to be. Well, some 52 years later, JFK's dream is unraveling, say some.
America's position in the world is far from secure, acclaimed author George Packer argues in his new book, The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. Growing poverty, a struggling economy, a fractious and often poisonous political system. The American establishment is falling apart in the land of opportunity, according to Packer. Monocle's news editor Tom Edwards caught up with the author when he came by our New York bureau.
Now, I was quite struck by, in particular, a sort of a credit that was at the end of the book where you mentioned that you were, in some sense, I don't know whether it's structurally or in terms of a narrative idea, indebted to, well, the brilliant John Dos Passos trilogy USA, which is actually one of my favourite books.
That's great to hear. Very few people seem to know it any longer.
Oh, that's a crying shame. Well, I just wondered, what was it about that book? Was it a narrative structure? Was it something about capturing a zeitgeist? What was it about that book in particular that seemed to strike you when you sort of sat down to begin The Unwinding?
Well, I've loved that book since I first read The Big Money, the third of the trilogy, in my teens. I needed some model for how to organize what I was doing because I had this very ambitious project, which was to create a portrait of America over the past generation and to do it through a mix of obscure and famous American lives and powerful places like Wall Street and Washington and Silicon Valley, and also backwaters and forgotten places like the Rust Belt of the Midwest and rural North Carolina. And there's no nonfiction book that I'm aware of that attempts anything like this. And the only book at all that has a similar scope and narrative ingredients is USA. And so I finally said to my wife, I have no idea how I'm going to organize the narrative. And she said, but you did have an idea at the start of the project. You were going to try to do something along the lines of USA. And I had sort of tossed it away as a hopeless idea. It didn't seem doable in nonfiction form. But I set out to try to do something sort of experimental, something that I hadn't done before and that nonfiction hasn't done before. And so USA provided a rough model, although I had to depart from it in all sorts of ways to make it work.
Now let's talk a little bit about some of the kind of slightly more specific themes that you identify and sort of follow through the book. It's interesting, we talk about this sort of breakdown, the changes in the sort of character of the US, and often you suggest that the sort of voids that are left are filled with what you, I think, referred to in your introduction as organized money. Tell us, if you will, why do you think that is such a single kind of identifiable characteristic of the thing that's kind of flowed in and filled the kind of vacuums that were left behind?
You know, it's always there in American life. It's been there for at least a century and a half. It may be the default mode for organizing power and politics in America. And in some ways, what we're living through now is a bit of a throwback to the Gilded Age, to the turn of the 19th to 20th centuries, when these titans of industry like Andrew Carnegie and John D. Rockefeller, and a bit later Henry Ford, dominated the landscape and owned legislatures, and where legalized and not legalized bribery were normal ways of doing business in state houses and even in Washington. Well, we're back to that, except now their names are Mark Zuckerberg and Bill Gates, and they are both, you know, these huge forces in business, but also they are the salvation of a school district in Newark or of a public health system. So we seem to have returned to something that was interrupted by a half a century of what I call the Roosevelt Republic, when instead of private money and private interest driving society to such an extent, we had laws and structures and institutions, schools, government agencies, even businesses that seemed to function more on behalf of a majority of people and with a sense of a public interest rather than simply pursuing private interests. So I think we may have returned to something that's always there in America, organized money, but which had been somewhat submerged by a more collective organization for a while when I was a kid.
Now, it's interesting. You mentioned a little earlier about Robert Rubin as one of the characters, and we chart these kind of movements between you know, Wall Street and White House, how these people, almost like a general elite that move between these different worlds. And perhaps they were rather blind to their own roles in a lot of the problems that happened. Do you think, as you write the book and put it in the context of what's happening in America today, that these elites are any closer to understanding their own role in some of these problems?
I think 2008 was the reckoning, and the book has this general trajectory toward that watershed year when so many things happened, so much fell apart, and also seemed to be reorganizing itself into a new era led by Barack Obama. But 2008 turned out not to be as historic a turning point as I and others thought it would. And in a way, the rot of our institutions was so deep that one man, even someone with the talents of Obama, just wasn't able to turn us in a new direction. We got pulled right back into the same sort of corrupt and corrosive politics and approach to business that we had been in before. So Robert Rubin is a talented, high-minded, in many ways admirable man who went from Goldman Sachs to the Clinton White House to being Treasury Secretary and then to Citigroup. He thought that Wall Street's interest and the interests of the country were close to synonymous and could be harmonized. And that was what that was sort of the worldview he brought to Washington. By 2008, they weren't just unharmonious. They were in direct opposition to each other. And Rubin didn't see it. He didn't understand that he was a successful example, product of an institution that no longer served larger interests. It served its own. And so when the financial crisis hit, he disappeared. He refused to take responsibility for his role and for what Citigroup had become, which was a practically broke, gigantic financial services corporation. And so I think the answer in short to your question is no. Our elites have not seen their role. In fact, if anything, in the years since 2008, we've seen them pull farther away from the rest of American society.
And what do you think, George, is responsible for that? Because it's telling in your book, there's some really heartbreaking tales, particularly in the latter stages. There's the stories of the Hartzell family, particularly in Tampa. It's really moving stuff. But it seems that kind of narrative doesn't gain traction with some of these people. As you say there, people just not interested in learning the lessons that these heartbreaking tales tell. What do you think is the reason for that? Is one of the causes some of the very kind of splenetic, angry rhetoric that we get from certain commentators, perhaps on the right wing in the US, particularly amongst some of the right-leaning media? I mean, are they partly to blame for this, in your view?
Absolutely. I think media in general is partly to blame, some of it for polarizing and poisoning the atmosphere in order to raise its ratings and make more money. Some of it simply for not really paying much attention, for being drawn magnetically to the stories of wealth and power in Washington and Silicon Valley and Wall Street. So we had this great recession, which really I think of as a depression, not quite on the scale of the 30s, but moving toward that. And yet there was just so little really serious coverage of it from the point of view of people like the Hartzell family in Tampa, a family of four who were living on part-time, $8.50 an hour work at Walmart, and people like them all over the country. It's just not a glamorous story. It's not a story that the media seems to want to pay much attention to. So instead, the financial crisis was filtered through the experience of hedge fund managers and bank regulators and bank executives. And that seems symptomatic of a more stratified America than the one I grew up in, where the elites are a class unto themselves, a sort of superclass and a global superclass. And our politicians, our entertainers, our business leaders are all part of it and exist with each other apart from the vast majority of Americans, so that they don't have a sense of a deep connection that would say, my interests may lead me in this direction, but if I restrain myself to some extent, it might lead to a better outcome in the long run for more people. Instead, there is very little self-restraint, either on Capitol Hill or in corporate boardrooms or in big media.
George, just finally then, I wanted to ask you about, if we sort of look ahead, again, you mentioned this idea of the American voice and how the American voice endures and really what that means. It's interesting to go back to John Dos Passos. I get to finish where we began. That's a very clear voice which has stood the test of time. And it's sort of the legacy of that, I guess, is heard quite clearly in your book. Do you fear, when we look to the future, that even that American voice may not be heard adequately in the future, and the same kind of people with their bloody-mindedness and their slightly delusional obsession with the pursuit of money, do you fear that the American voice in the future will be their voice and that we'll lose a lot of the true expressions of what it is to be an American?
You know, in my book, I wanted to privilege the voices of ordinary people so that the main characters are people the reader hasn't heard of, a black woman in Youngstown, Ohio, a sort of striving entrepreneur in rural North Carolina. And their voices are the strongest ones in the book. And I hope they will survive and will be heard by a lot of readers. And there are a lot of Americans like them. I mean, this is a really gritty, resourceful country that seems able to come back from all kinds of challenges and to get knocked down and to get back up. And we have not gotten back up as a country. But when I'm thinking about Wall Street or Washington, Robert Rubin, Newt Gingrich, people like that, I feel pessimistic. But when I think about Dean Price in North Carolina, Tammy Thomas in Ohio, some of the people in Tampa, I feel some hopefulness that the kinds of ordinary dreams and aspirations that have been part of our country for so long and that are part of USA, the Dos Passos trilogy, those aren't going to die. That's not going to be changed out of existence. It's been sort of muted. It hasn't been heard enough, but I don't think it's going to go away. It's part of the fabric of the country.
That was Monocle's news editor there, Tom Edwards, speaking to George Packer, author of The Unwinding from our New York bureau.
In a moment, we'll be discussing everyone's favourite toy, Lego.
Every weekend here on Monocle 24, we like to take a break from the rigours of our hard-hitting news agenda and have a leisurely look at the arts.
Anything can be made interesting by looking at something long enough or from the right angle.
Starting at 8 a.m. London time on Saturdays, the weekend edition brings you a mix of music, news, and very special guests with me, Georgina Godwin.
I discovered that I was enjoying listening to it as a piece of music, not just as an installation in that gallery. I thought, this sounds like a new album.
I'll be talking to a variety of talent from the worlds of literature, music, theatre, and television, as well as introducing you to new selections from our global playlist.
It's something entrenched and strange, and it's a mysterious relationship with your own creativity, and it's a lifelong negotiation.
That's the weekend edition, Saturday from 8 a.m. and Sundays from 16 to 1800 hours, London time, right here on Monocle 24.
It's everyone's favourite childhood toy.
Lego is here. Hey, kids, look. A whole new world to build. 'Cause Lego is here.
This young boy has such fun. He used Lego one by one. Wibbity-knack-patty-whack, don't stop a plane. This young boy glad Lego came.
Lego, a whole new world to build. Lego, the sensation of Europe, now made in America by Samsonite, who make it better for longer-lasting fun.
And not that you'd know it, but Lego's been around since the 1940s. Not that you'd know it from that bang-up-to-date advert. And it's captured the imagination of kids and of adults as well. Andrew, were you a Lego kid?
Yes, I had a whole tin of little Lego bricks. I don't think you could build that much. There was a garage and a house. Those are the two kind of main things that you could construct from it.
That was quite sort of constructionist.
Yes, I was always doing a little house. And then
it was quite austere, Lego set.
Do you know, the weird thing is, I think somewhere I still have that box of bricks.
Yeah, of course you do. You've got to have your box of bricks. I was a space Lego boy.
Yeah, you're a bit younger than me, so I think...
Well, I was sort of an early 80s Lego kid, I think.
They were probably biplanes when I was... I was using my bricks.
That's what we like about it. And, of course, the whole point is you get the instructions on the box, but the whole point is that you want to make something that you're not allowed to, isn't it? You kind of want to break out, don't you? Because it was always the thing. It was like you get the spaceship.
That's true, but I was making a bungalow. So what does that say about me? A lack of ambition, I think. Anyway, Rob, there's a new book out by author David Robertson titled Brick by Brick, How Lego Rewrote the Rules of Innovation and Conquered the Toy Industry. It traces the company from its roots and examines how it managed to stave off bankruptcy and reinvent itself into the empire it is today. And David Robertson joins us now in the studio. Welcome to the show. We were referencing there that all of us seem to have had some kind of story with Lego, an extraordinary brand. And I think you have a few facts at the beginning of the book saying There's kind of 80 bricks in the world for every man, woman and child. And it's incredible reach. Before we pick up the story of its demise and rebirth again, just take us back to the early days. What made Lego such a success and managed to kind of, you know, spread around the world?
I think it was the grandson of the founder. When he took over in 1978, he did a couple of real innovations that I think changed the company and changed its fortune. So the brick as we know it was patented in 1958, and the company grew fairly steadily and slowly after that. But when the grandson of the founder took over, a guy named Kjell Kirk Christensen, he did a couple of pretty amazing innovations. One was he really put emphasis behind Duplo, the bigger bricks for
that's
smaller
the
hands.
The sort of baby Lego,
yeah,
isn't
yeah,
it?
Lego for kids, yeah. Lego for toddlers, so they Lego don't swallow
kids.
It.
Yeah, because he thinks you get Legos for adults.
Well, then he also did that. He did the technique, oh, yeah, which has the, right, yeah, the gears and the beams and the motors. And the idea being that kids leave Lego around 10 or 12, and if you make something more sophisticated, then teenagers might play with Lego. And for the most part, that failed. But he did find 25 to 55-year-old men that loved it, and so the toy sold quite well. But the big innovation that he did, I think, was the minifigure. In 1978, the first little Lego person came out. And I'll give you my business card, by the way. I've redesigned my business card.
Oh, I love this. David's given us, by the way, a little Lego man. Now, is that this is you, right?
With moving arms.
This is basically
And legs.
Well, you can tell. It's a little cheaper to make mine because I don't need hair for it.
So here he is, and he's got the blue pants and a white T-shirt, a long sleeve T-shirt, and he's got his glasses. A decent pair of glasses there.
Yeah, I gave the more formal one to your colleague
specs.
Here.
Yeah. Oh, that's right.
The minifigure changed everything because what it did is it rescaled Lego. Before, they had a Lego family that was about 10 bricks tall, and they had a Lego train that was even taller but still wouldn't fit the family inside, but both of those would tower over those Lego bungalows that you were building. When they brought out the Lego minifigure and the space and the castle sets around it, everything was at the same scale around the minifigure. And so even today, you know, if Hermione Granger gets in trouble, then Obi-Wan Kenobi can save her, right? I mean, you can bring these sets together and play out your own little dramas.
It's the sequel that everyone's dreading, David. Right?
And just tell me the Danishness of it all and an argument even about whether they should do Star Wars, because at the heart of it was this very Nordic ideal of, you know, no war and they shouldn't be celebrating any violence and things. How vital is that? Because it's extraordinary. It's still a family-owned Danish company.
It is, yeah. And it was a huge debate. You know, was Star Wars G.I. Joe or Ivanhoe? You know, was it a modern warfare, which they still, to this day, say they will never celebrate? Or was it this, you know, iconic, more traditional story? And they finally decided that it was more of that story. And it was a tremendous success for them. I mean, Star Wars really brought in some huge revenues. But I think more importantly, Star Wars taught Lego the power of story. The toys that you were talking about, that you know, when you just built houses or things like that, that captivated kids somewhat. But when you could build a Harry Potter set or a Star Wars set and then play out the drama in that set, that really, I think, attracted kids' imaginations. And so since then, Lego have become very story-driven.
And it's a crazy thing. I mean, there are so many videos on YouTube of people making their own kind of Lego reconstructions of famous world events. And there's Lego album covers. Like people redoing Patti Smith horses and the White Stripes album covers and classic album covers in Lego.
One of my favorite.
And reconstructing pop videos in Lego. So it's probably become a kind of, I hate to use the word, like it's kind of been derailed by hipsterishness, but it certainly kind of still captures the imaginations. Presumably the people making these videos, painstaking kind of stop animation videos, are people that grew up with the bricks, with the little mini characters, right?
Yeah, I would urge your listeners to Google Eddie Izzard's Star Wars Canteen.
Yeah, this is good.
You've seen it where they acted out in Lego, but it's Eddie Izzard talking about what it would be like if Darth Vader went down to the canteen and tried to order lunch.
Now, tell me, where is the hiccup in this story, though? So we know that through, you know, well into the 80s, they were doing very well as a company. Then suddenly something goes wrong, and there's an amazing chart in your book. It's a nice little graphic starting off when I was young, and they sold almost no bricks, and then it starts shooting up, and then there's this falling off a cliff.
Yeah, so they got in trouble, I think, starting in 1993. So to take a step back, the grandson of the founder takes over in 1978. He does Duplo, he does Technique, he does the fantasy sets, he does the minifigure. That launches Lego on this 15-year period of double-digit growth. They're doubling in size every 5 years for 15 years. And then they reach the natural end of that at about 93, and they go through this stagnant period between 93 and 98, where they keep trying to come up with more sales and they try more different toys, but sales don't go anywhere, and they end up having the first loss in company history in 1998. They lay off 1,000 people. The grandson of the founder steps aside. He says, I've been running this company for 20 years. Maybe I'm not the right person to run it for the next 20. They go out and they look at the market and they find that, you know, this is 1999. Everything's about virtual experiences and internet and PlayStations and Nintendos. And they say, maybe the brick is passé. And so they just start innovating. They start experimenting and coming out with any kind of idea they can think of. You know, if you were a designer in 2000, 2001 in Lego, you were just told to come out with a great play experience, do something new, do something cool. And some of those worked. Like Star Wars was tremendously successful, but it was only successful in years in which there was a Star Wars movie. So 99, 2002, there were Star Wars movies. Harry Potter was very successful, but only in years in which there was a movie. So 2001 and 2002, there was Harry Potter movies. There was no movie from either franchise in 2003 and the first half of 2004. Sales of those two toys fall off a cliff. All that's left is all these other experiments, and they're not especially Lego-y. You know, there's not a lot of construction as part of the experience. They're not very profitable, and the company almost goes bankrupt in 2003.
I really want to see a David Lynch movie turned into Lego. The anti-franchise.
So now, what's interesting about your book is, you know, it's obviously, in many senses, you know, it's a traditional business book. It's kind of like it tells the story of a company and how it revives its fortunes and the tenets of that. But what's interesting is, in many ways, it's kind of saying, actually, every company needs to think its, you know, own solution, because what they did and what other companies do, you can't kind of take rules from all these other business books and all these other business schools and apply them to Lego, because they kind of tried to do that. They tried to take the best lessons of the day about how you should innovate and how you should change your culture, perhaps not be too Danish, perhaps pull in people from around the world. And it kind of didn't work. They had to come up with their own solution. So give us one or two examples of what they thought of to do that began to turn the story back around again.
Yeah, so I think one of the key lessons from the book is about the power of the little idea. There's lots of things out there, lots of books and ideas and theories about how to make that next big innovation, the blue ocean, the disruptive innovation, the whatever it is. And Lego tried those and wasn't especially good at it and still isn't especially good at it. But on the other hand, what they realized is, you know, out-of-the-box innovation almost put them out of business, because they forgot about how much money there was in the box, that people like those, you know, fire trucks and police stations and the everyday Lego toys that we all grew up with. And in that experimental period from 99 to 2002, they kind of forgot about doing those. And parents got disappointed in the toys that they saw on the shelves that didn't have much construction experience. And they got confused by some of the toys that came out that weren't very Lego-y.
Yeah.
And so people moved away from the brand. And when they came back, one of the first things that they did is they actually cut the number of pieces in their portfolio, in their supply chain and manufacturing operations, in half. Before, in 2001, 2002, if you were a designer and you wanted to create some new piece, you just created it. And they'd make the molds and they'd come up with the colors and they'd do it. Now, you have to work from a more tightly limited palette of shapes and colors, because they want those pieces to be reused in lots of different sets. And so they say, you know, when we put constraints around innovation, we actually found that it requires a different kind of creativity, but just as much of a challenge for creativity. And that what happens now...
You need a little edit. You need to be... It's like when you're writing something, you need a word count. Otherwise, you can't focus your brain. If you could write a 20,000-page novel, then you would never do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So yeah. A designer now, you come in and you're told, create a great police station, create a great fire truck. And some of the designers from 2001 and 2002 left the company. They felt too constrained. But the ones that are left, they say, you know, we know now that if we're working on that, there's a 90% chance that that product's going to get to market and into kids' hands, and the company's going to make money, and our jobs are going to be safe. And so, you know, there's a different kind of satisfaction from that.
David Robertson, author of Brick by Brick, How Lego Rewrote the Rules of Innovation and Conquered the Toy Industry. Thanks so much for joining us here in the studio on The Weekly. And there we have it, Andrew. That's all for edition 209.
I like the Lego story. I like a man who has a Lego character as his business card.
I know, because on the press release for the book, it had quite a large picture of him as a Lego person. I was going to kind of go, oh, I don't really like your picture. But then he kind of did a better joke by bringing himself into the office.
And he was very generous as you pulled his head on and off throughout the interview.
I know, exactly. I felt a little bit bad for that. Imagine if it really worked as a voodoo shrine. Imagine a voodoo charm. Imagine the pain he's in now. I think he had to catch a plane, didn't he?
Yes.
He was off to catch a plane.
He had a big suitcase with him anyway.
So I hope he's got a flatbed or something. He'll be having awful pains if I've messed around with his head, his spine, all the rest of it. I twisted his arms almost completely off.
He's probably out in our garden now, kind of putting the last bricks on the tail of the plane.
Build your own son. That's the way forward. I quite like that show. One of my favourite parts of the show was the realisation that Tom Edwards is a spitting image of diminutive comedian from the 80s, Ronnie Corbett.
He didn't look too happy about it.
He didn't like that, did he? Now he's gone. It's fine. We can talk about it. We bless Tom Edwards and all those that sail within him. And also, come on, we can take the mickey out of a man that's got about four of his own theme tunes, right? That's all right. He must know he's secretly really loved. Should we thank our cats the other side of the glass and shift on out of here, Andrew, and go on our holidays?
Okay. Well, I'll thank Phil Hahn.
Okay. Thank you, Phil Hahn, who was the producer of today's weekly. Our studio manager was Jack Phillips. It's good night from me.
And it's good night from him.
Thank you for tuning in.